HPPodCraft.com.
That wall had been an example of the worst snide construction. Though little more than a year old, the parts left standing showed evidence that they had begun to decay the day the last brick was laid. Here and there, a brick had cracked and dropped out. Fibrils of the climbing vines had penetrated crevices, working for early destruction. One side had already fallen. It was here that the first glimmering suspicion of the terrible truth was forced upon me. The scattered bricks, even those which had rolled inward toward the gaping foundation ledge, had not been coated with scum.
Not coated with scum? Oh, the horror!
Yeah, the absence of something is a great device for detective story. Like, the paint isn't faded here in a square shape, so I know there was a painting hanging on this wall.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're trying to convey shock and horror, something just not being there is... It's good detective work on the nature of the monster, but I don't know if it needed to be italicized as it was.
No. Guess what? Everything in my room right now that I'm sitting in, none of it's covered in slime. Those italicized words are from the fifth chapter of Ooze by Anthony M. Rudd, and we're covering it here on the H.P. Lovecraft literary podcast, Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
We are on Patreon with you today. You can also find us at hppodcraft.com. There are still some old subscribers who are hanging around on Witch House Media and getting the show that way. We are finally going to retire that this October. I don't know if we've made that announcement yet, but we're working on a new site, or Chris is rather, and we plan to launch around that time. So we're going to consolidate, streamline, try to make it easier for everybody, and Witch House Media will be going away. So if you're listening on this and you haven't received my emails in the past, please come over to Patreon to subscribe. It's a much better experience and you get more content.
Lots more content. Hey, who was that reader?
Why, that was once again our friend Anne Elizabeth, i.e. Fool.
Yeah.
That's Fool with a PH. Jester, DJ, writer, igniter, Milwaukee's official jester. She is live with Fool and the Gang on Fridays at 6 p.m. Central U.S. time. We'll link out to all this goodness in the show notes. Her studio, and you can see this if you tune into the show, the Fool Out Shelter, features a spooky, scary skeleton called Uncle Fweddy.
Aww.
It's true. And her annual Fooloween show is a macabre for everyone who's ghoulishly inclined. She wanted me to mention that, since that would be of interest to our listeners. So thanks so much, AE, for providing these readings for us for the 2 weeks. It's been good to talk with you. On that show, by the way, they've also been known to play a little Pitch Black Manor here and there.
Ooh,
so proceed with caution when you listen. Let's get back to Ooze.
Our story so far involves an unnamed narrator and his quest to find out what happened to his married coupled friends, Lee Cranmer and Peggy Breed. Lee's father, a scientist named John Corliss Cranmer, went stark raving mad and confessed to killing them both, but no bodies or motive was ever found. Recently, Cranmer Sr. escaped from the mental institution, and that's what's prompted our narrator to investigate. All of this is happening in the Alabama swamps at the ruins of the Cranmer Sr.'s lab and cabin. What we heard at the top is about the wall that was built around the house after the incident happened, though we're not sure yet what exactly has happened.
I mean, we're pretty sure. To play along with the story, we don't understand it yet.
Yeah.
But the timelines are a little confusing because of the way the story is told. But this investigation the narrator is doing is actually 4 years after the deaths. Remember, we were kind of trying to figure this out. I don't know exactly when in that time the guy escaped from the institution, but we know that it's 4 years later because of the narrator, who is a journalist of some kind, was given care of the young dead couple's baby, Elsie, who is now 4. She called him Daddy, your papa, and that touched him so much he thought, you know, I got to get the truth of what happened to her family instead of the conjecture that's out there so that she can know what happened. Yes. And so it's the missing scientist, but it's really that. I don't know if by this point he would know that the missing scientist is not just missing.
Yeah.
But he doesn't conclusively know that till he does the investigation. This is why it's all confusing. And and to add to that, the whole thing is in Alabama, so it's making me think of Crawford Tillinghast, like he should be out there defending somebody against these rumors and conjecture.
So Cranmer Sr. was working on microbial studies with single-celled organisms. Now our narrator is on the scene trying to figure out more about what happened. Everything in the walls is covered with this slime, while everything outside is not. And there was a theory that the slime inside was caused by a flood, but if there was a flood, there would be slime on the outside.
That's why it's scary that there's some missing ooze. Clearly a monster came out of the pit and wrecked the place.
Upon closer examination, the wall itself is pretty poor quality. Obviously, it was done as a rush job.
Yeah, and we, as we talked about in the last episode, he threatened the workers to do it quickly. So that's the kind of job you're gonna get, you know, if you're told, if people are told they'll be murdered if they talk about the job. They might be a little nervous and that'll influence their work, but also pride in your work is a big motivator. Somebody knowing that you did something, like say you're in a Target or some other big department store and there's a bag of potato chips in the lingerie section. And you're like, what gives? Why is this here? I was in the store, realized I didn't want the chips. Nobody was watching me. So I just put it back in whatever section I was in. That's the reason that happens. Yeah. I'm not going to walk all the way back to the snack section.
No.
Because it's anonymous. Same thing happened here.
The narrator feels he's at a dead end. So he begins to ask the locals if they know anything. And on the 11th day of his investigation, he runs into this guy, Rory Paleron, occasion. Now, the narrator had a hard time getting the locals to talk to an outsider, but Rory loosened up pretty fast with the little moonshine, and that was waved under his nose. The narrator spends the evening with Rory, getting him drunk, and it doesn't take much to get him babbling. It's a bit of a Zadok Allen thing going on here.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that Lovecraft lifted this. This happens in several stories, but this is really directly like Zadok Allen. And I'm guessing that Lovecraft lifted this plying them with drink strategy from the fiction he was reading. I don't know if he was out in some watering hole. But, and also the idea that getting somebody drunk will lead to, I mean, it'll definitely lead to some personal details coming out that maybe you didn't expect. But alcohol as truth serum, I'm always a little suspicious of in stories, because I found that things tend to get a little fictional as people get more inebriated. The story starts sounding better if it has maybe bigger moments. And then it starts getting disjointed, which there's a lot of that in here. I mean, the narrator has to piece together small details.
Now, Rory explains that he knew Joe Sibley, the guy who did the cooking and the housework for Cranmer. Rory would deliver food to the lodge, mostly veggies, but eventually meat. Lots of meat. So Rory goes on and says that Lee and Peggy were at the lodge for about 10 days. They were going to go to Cuba for a few weeks and then they were going to come back, but they stayed longer than they were supposed to because something was going on at the lodge. As they stayed, the orders for meat grew and grew. Eventually, he was delivering whole animals. Lee didn't want Rory talking to his dad about what was going on, so he paid him double. He told Rory it was for his dad's own good, and that he'll have the scientific world at his feet with this discovery.
Again, there was some confusion in the narrative here. It was a nuance it took me a while to get, which I'm sure we're going to have exposed as we go through the synopsis, but the younger guy was just as responsible, if not more so, or if not totally. In terms of the monstrosity. Well, his dad started this thing, but he's the one that came up with these harebrained, let's just let it keep growing schemes. Basically, he took charge of the care and feeding of the monster in the pit, which it took me a while to kind of figure out. I don't know. I feel like the story would have done better if it was just the mad scientist out there or just some clearer roles.
Yeah. Before he left for Cuba, Lee offered Rory $500 to throw food into this pool and another $500 when he got back. He was throwing in two hogs a night. And to me, this sounds so much like the Dunwich Horror, but also the case of Charles Dexter Ward, remember, because they needed the flesh.
Yeah, in both of those cases, it's like, I've got a secret. The only way you know I have a secret is because a large amount of meat keeps showing up. That trope is in both of those stories. I'm sure that the idea started here.
It had to have. So the narrator asks if it was a gator that was in this pit, and Rory says, no, I don't think so. I don't know, and I don't want to know.
Diable! How should I know? It was dark. I wouldn't go close. Some of this colloquial writing, too, that you find in Lovecraft's work. Maybe you'd have done it, huh? Not me, though. The young fella told me to sling it in, and I slung it. That's a weird job to have, you know, just pull up with a bunch of meat. Don't look. Just go throw it in a pit. Collect your money.
Yeah.
How do you file for that on income tax?
I don't think you do. He came around a few times during the day to kind of check out what was going on, but he never saw anything. So maybe this creature only came out at night.
Well, it is a man-eater.
At this point in the retelling, Rory is getting even more drunk, and it seems that when Lee came back, he wanted the thing fed even more. So he started purchasing whole hogs and sheep, many per day. Two hogs! Keeps bringing up the two hogs! Lee was excited by all of this.
If one hog doesn't thrill you, what do you say to two hogs?
It says here, he had a tremendous secret, one the extent of which even his father did not guess, and one which would astonish the world. Only a week or two more, and he would spring it. First, he would have to arrange certain data. That day never came because Lee and Peggy disappeared soon after. Rory went to check on the place after that, and he heard a scream, and he knew that that was the scream of Joe, the cook.
Throwing a pair of number two shells into the breech of his shotgun, Rory hurried on, taking his usual path through the brush at the back. He stood in the yard, far from the pool into which Rory had thrown the carcasses, and Joe could not move. Rory failed to explain in full, but something, a slimy, amorphous something which glistened in the sunlight, already engulfed the man to his shoulders. Breath was cut off. Joe's contorted face writhed with horror and beginning suffocation. One hand, all that was free of the rest of him, beat feebly upon the rubbery, translucent thing that was engulfing his body. Then, Joe sank from sight.
Your Honor, my defendant the Ewes was merely protecting his property. And in fact, once he tasted Joe the cook and realized he was friendly, Ewes transformed his action into a great big hug, as was seen by this inebriated witness, Rory. And it was an unfortunate heart condition that doomed Joe. As we all know, his gravy, while delicious, turns to spackle in the arteries. In fact, I believe some remuneration is in order for my client, the Ooze, who still suffers from bouts of violent eructation as a result of consuming, I mean hugging, Joe the cook.
Crawford Tillinghast, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow.
I didn't see it from that perspective, but, you know,
yeah,
he gets in there and...
Not guilty. That's my verdict. After the incident, Rory drank a bunch more and convinced himself that he didn't really see what he thought he saw. And he came back a week later and found the wall had been built, which was around the whole place, including the pool that he had been throwing the meat into. But from inside, he heard crashing and could see the lodge collapsing and falling in on itself. The whole roof caved in and the whole place came down. At this point in the storytelling, Rory is useless.
To the author, because yes, he's laid out what we need, basically. The father was doing something, Junior took over, things got out of hand. The old man built the wall to deal with the fallout of what his son had done.
Now, the narrator is left wondering how much of this is true and how much of this is drunk guy stuff. He comes back the next day and finds Rory had actually continued drinking after he left and was still passed out. But he had this lockbox, like, you know, for fishing, a tackle box. And inside this lockbox was a notebook. The book was a record of laboratory data. Obviously, it wasn't Rory's because Rory couldn't read.
Yeah.
I thought this was silly because even if he could read, why would he be taking lab notes?
Yeah, the author clearly wasn't done with him yet. He thought, well, I'd like to give our narrator a little more information. Rory's probably got a tackle box I could put something in. That's a very video game thing to find in a guy's tackle box.
This.
And then you'd have to sit there and listen to the reading of it. Oh, what's this say? Oh, it's one of these things where I gotta read a journal entry to me. Moving on. That's me playing video games. Anytime I see journal entries, I get so upset. This whole story needs an editor,
I
was realizing as we're closing in on it. And we mentioned in the last episode that Farnsworth Wright also had some stories in this issue of Weird Tales, because this is from the very first issue. I don't know who the editor was. I mean, I could easily look it up, but I didn't.
Yeah.
Farnsworth, I'm sure, was reading this, having all the same gripes as us from reading later notes he made on other stories. So I'm sure he was thinking, this is a great idea. Why don't you clean up the narrative?
Yeah.
I know that investigations themselves are conflicting and confusing, but I don't think that's a justification for doing it in the story, because that's the investigator's problem.
Exactly.
I'm being told the story.
Yes.
You know, when you read Lovecraft, I might get lost within one of his sentences, but he refined this. I never got lost in his plots.
No. Now, the narrator recognizes the handwriting. It's Cranmer Sr. And the first words read, "Could he not have obeyed my instructions?" He asked Rory about this journal, and Rory fesses that he saw Cranmer on top of the wall, crouched down. As he came near, Cranmer got up, threw the notebook down, raised his arms up to the sky, and then jumped in the wall. You know, Rory knew that this part where he was on the wall was right next to the pool that he was throwing the meat into.
Yeah, so he jumped from the wall into the pool, presumably, which is good timing on Rory's part to just show up when that happens. But yeah. I imagine maybe the doctor was hanging out with his journal all day on top of that wall, just waiting for somebody to happen by so he could be more dramatic about it. Again, you want credit for your work. If you're going to dramatically commit suicide in a pit of ooze, one person's got to see it, no matter how drunk.
Somebody. Now we get the lowdown from the book.
John Corliss Cranmer went insane for sufficient cause, says...
Before the narrator goes into it, he explains that Lee Cranmer was a writer of fantastic stories of scientific nature. The term sci-fi, I think we talked about this last week, wasn't really in use at this time. Lee had lofty ideas about what science could do. Lee had written three novels, two of which were inspired by his father's work.
Yeah, we did talk about this in the last episode, and I might have even read this segment, but let me read it again. It says, a yarn based upon solid fact in the field of astronomy, chemistry, anthropology, or whatnot, which carries to logical conclusion improved theories of men who devote their lives to searching out further nadirs of fact. This is how he's describing this sort of pre-science fiction genre. Continues, in certain fashion, these men are allies of science. Often they visualize something which has not been imagined, even by the best of men from whom they secure data, thus opening new horizons of possibility. In a large way, Jules Verne was one of these men in his day. Mm-hmm. Agreed, but there's a little bit of artistic self-aggrandizing there, though, because science fiction tends to popularize ideas. I think it generates enthusiasm for the possibilities of science.
Yeah.
And maybe would even lead somebody with the intellect necessary to get some of these things done into the field. But to say that scientists just didn't come up with these things until they read them in the story is a bit much.
Yeah.
I think they are thinking those things and dreaming those things. They just don't fictionalize it. They do it in their actual scientific work. And also, as I was thinking about this, there's very little actually in the way of technology that probably wasn't imagined in some primal way. Are we really doing things that are that extraordinary in terms of these breakthroughs? I mean, flight and being able to talk to somebody on the other side of the planet, or all of these things I'm sure in its infancy mankind was imagining being able to do.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing things are happening with technology now. I was reading where they were talking about how the chariot was invented maybe 2500 BC, somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. And the chariot was the fastest vehicle until the steam train was invented, which was in the 1800s.
Right.
And then after the steam train, less, I think it was 60 years after the steam train was invented, about that, the Wright brothers flew. And then 60 years after that, we were on the moon.
Yeah, it's exponential.
Yeah.
Because the breakthroughs lead to faster breakthroughs.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
The thing that I was actually thinking about just this morning that was amusing me is how quickly, I mean, we've said this a lot, that humans are very adaptable. So we catch up with the technology, or at least becomes part of our lives in a kind of a normal way fairly quickly, even though it's rolling out pretty fast.
Yeah.
We adapt to it pretty quick, and then we become derisive of the old technologies pretty quick. So I think in another episode I pointed out, I love that Fred Armisen joke where he's like, why are we so mean to medieval doctors? They were doing their best. Yeah. Similarly, if I watch something that's set in the 80s, do you have to make fun of the videotapes and the large cell phones? Because you didn't invent the iPhone, yet the people who are making these things go, look at these morons with their giant phones. Or let's make a scene where we show how difficult it is for him to get the videotape or something. They just really fetishize this older technology. It's just a couple of years ago, guys. You're not responsible for the updates in the digital world, so cut it out.
Yeah.
That's just the way the world was.
That's a strange thing, because if you set something, say, in the 1890s or the 1920s, people don't make a big whoop out of that stuff. You know, there's not that same ridicule that there is for like 80s technology or 80s video games. Or maybe it's because that's in our current memory. You know, like I remember the Nintendo Power Glove.
Right, right.
When it came out, whereas like, I don't think, I obviously don't remember the 1920s having a phone that you had to pick up and put one bit to your ear and talk in the other bit and ask the operator to connect you to a person. I wouldn't make fun of that because I don't have any memory of it.
I think you're exactly right, because it's more of when you're doing something and it's set in a time that's a bit distant, what you want to do is show the commonalities. So oftentimes, actually, I've been watching a lot of movies from the 40s recently. They're pretty technologically advanced, actually. It surprises me how many things they're able to get done, and all of the things they have that are non-internet but still kind of do the same functions. They don't make a big deal out of it, but it's happening in the background. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you set things in that period, you might show how, things were pretty much the same. It was just different technologies. Whereas if it is something from recent history, your challenge is to show how different it is from right now. So you do want to make fun of those things and point them out. Because otherwise it just feels like modern day.
Yeah. Times have changed.
Times have changed. But you know what hasn't changed? The ability of amoebas to grow. They don't have it.
No.
But in this story, that breakthrough was made.
Now, it seems Kramer Sr. has devised a way to create unlimited growth in protozoic life, in amoeba specifically.
Right, which is all in service of unlimited growth in multicelled organisms later. It says in the story, in time and with cooperation of biologists who have specialized upon karyokinesis and embryology of higher forms, he hoped, to put the theory in pragmatic terms, to be able to grow swine the size of elephants, quail or woodcock with breasts from which 100 weight of white meat could be cut away, and steers whose dehorned heads might butt at the third story of a skyscraper. This guy's talking about making kaiju steer? What? How about a big tomato? I actually went in to highlight this passage, and I was sure for some reason that there was a mention of a giant pumpkin or something like that, but no.
Yeah.
No. Weird Tales was just a steakhouse bathroom mag at this point. You know? Wow. Why would you do that? What a weird thing to imagine. We can make monstrous cows. Like two, three times the size. You know, let's think. And then a lot of them. But you're going to make one giant animal?
That cannot be manageable.
Yeah, that'll work out.
Now, Cranmer Sr. grew an amoeba to the size of an animal's liver. You know, like it would fill up, if you cupped your hands together, two of your hands, it would fill up two cupped hands, about that size. Mm. He showed it to Lee, and Lee encouraged his father to grow it larger and then reveal it to the scientific community. Cranmer Sr. told Lee that it must be destroyed, and Lee said, oh, okay, sure. And he told Lee, here you go, burn it, because if any of it lives, it might be able to grow anew, because obviously they reproduce asexually.
Yeah.
It could be a real problem if he didn't dispose of it appropriately.
Yeah, you'd have a them kind of situation where mm-hmm. are the, you know, queen ants? We have to find them because they could keep reproducing. It sounds like it could be a real problem. So that makes it extra confusing that the doctor did not deal with it himself.
Yeah.
While he had the, I got an idea. While you have the amoeba in your cupped hands, close your hands. Done. Smush it all up. It must have taken such intense work and research and practice and experimentation to grow this thing. So he wouldn't see it through to the end. It does strain credulity, you know. And it says in the journal, the first thing it says, why couldn't he have obeyed my instructions? Has this guy met humans? Like, people don't follow instructions. They're way too full of themselves. That you could give somebody who, Rory, could go, I don't know much about anything. And you could say, okay, here's a set of instructions from an expert who does. As soon as you were gone, Rory would still go, well, 1 through 5, I don't really need to read. Why don't I just get to the 1? You know, this is just the way people are. They can't keep track of things. Have you ever sent somebody an email with 2 questions? They can't. Yeah. You will not get an answer to one of them. Or you'll get some third answer not related to anything. This is a super James Bond movie move. That must have been what you thought of. You know, just go kill him in the other room. We don't need to see it. I'm sure it'll happen. James Bond won't escape.
No. So Lee took it to be burned, but then decided, you know what? I want to grow it on my own. And he put it in the pool behind the lodge, and he arranged for it to be fed by Rory. But when he came back from Cuba, it had grown much faster than he imagined, and it ate more than 2 hogs a day.
Maybe where Rudd grew up, there was some regional legend about some monster eating 2 hogs, and that's why he keeps bringing it up in here.
It comes up a lot. So that one day, Peggy, who wasn't told about this giant amoeba thing, was out back feeding the dogs for hunting. She got too close to the pool and got hit with a pseudopod. The pseudopod stretched 10 feet from the pool, so it has quite a grip on it. It pulled her in, and Lee tried to stop it, and he got pulled in as well.
At the beginning of the story, it kept going on and on about how intelligent these people were, you know, that their folksiness and their clever minds were not hurt by them also being fabulously wealthy. And even then, it sounded like that doth protest too much. But after this, I say, yeah, that's bull. Because drunk Rory... No, who can't read and had no information about what was going on, was like, I'm not getting near that thing. I throw the meat over and I split. So why would this guy be like, hey, wifey, if you wouldn't mind, go wander around by that hole out there and feed the dogs. Why are the dogs out there?
I don't know.
This thing eats 2 hogs. That's that means that the dog looks like a little appetizer.
Yeah.
John Corliss Cranmer was by no means a coward. He stared, cried aloud, then ran indoors, seizing the first 2 weapons which came to hand, a shotgun and hunting knife which lay in sheath in a cartridge belt across hook of the hall tree. The knife was 10 inches in length and razor keen. Cranmer rushed out again. He saw an indecent fluid something which as yet he had not had time to classify, lumped into a 6-foot-high center before his very eyes. It looked like one of the microorganisms he had studied, one grown to frightful dimensions, an amoeba. There, some minutes suffocated in the rubbery folds, yet still apparent beneath the glistening ooze of this monster, were 2 bodies.
His son and his daughter-in-law are dead, consumed by this thing underneath it. He knew that they were dead. He still tried to help them. Cutting at the thing did nothing. It would almost heal instantly once he stabbed it. Shooting it didn't do anything. A pseudopod tried to grab him, but he was able to slice off the pseudopod and get away from it. And that's the end of the journal, except for something quickly scribbled on the last page when he was on the wall before he jumped in.
A little too hastily scribbled. I think he did that in the morning because he knew it needed to look that way. Then he stood on that wall all day waiting for Rory to show up. I don't buy it.
Kramer bought a bunch of pigs to keep the thing fed while the workers built the wall. He figured once the wall was built that it would starve to death. He tried to set some timber to burn. He thought maybe the fire would kill it, but that had no effect. It's believed that it ate everything that it could inside those walls, and then it threw itself against the wall, eventually weakening it.
During some of its last struggles, undoubtedly, the side wall of brick was weakened. Not to collapse, however, until the giant amoeba no longer could take advantage of the breach. In final death lassitude, the amoeba stretched itself out in a thin layer over the ground. There it succumbed, though there is no means of estimating how long a time intervened. The last paragraph in Cranmer's notebook, scrawled so badly that it is possible some words I have not deciphered correctly, reads as follows. In my work, I have found the means of creating a monster. The unnatural thing, in turn, has destroyed my work and those whom I held dear. It is in vain that I assure myself of innocence of spirit. Mine is the crime of presumption. Now, as expedition, worthless though that may be, I give myself. It is better not to think of that last leap and the struggle of an insane man in the grip of the dying monster.
That's the end of the story.
So he escaped and ran back and killed himself?
Yeah.
I like the elements of the story, but it's odd. Normally I like things better after we cover them, but I got a little disenchanted with it as we went along.
Yeah.
It's got lots of cool stuff going on in it. And for the first issue of Weird Tales, you can see that this was really instrumental in getting us the stories that we got later that we've mentioned a bunch. Specifically, Dunwich Horror, I think, came from this. And then those parts of Call of Cthulhu that are in the swamp and Charles Dexter Ward. So a good progenitor of Lovecraft's work. But in this one, I'm going to say Lovecraft did it better.
He did.
Just sort of James Bond mood. And the amoeba's dead, right? It stretched itself because it couldn't eat anymore. It died from no food.
Yeah. And then I guess it caused the wall to fall on itself. I'm very confused what happened. That somehow the wall, when it fell in, it crushed it. And it was so weak from not eating that it couldn't get itself out from underneath the rocks. And then it just died.
See, I feel like they could have done a little more, but maybe it split off or it's still out there.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. It was confusing to read. There was a lot of me rereading stuff to try and understand it. And even bits like this end, I'm not exactly sure what happened, like how the creature finally died. And I've read it a few times, so
yeah.
I don't think it's very clear. And it really does need an editor. I wish Farnsworth was editing at this time.
It is also a valuable thing for things to be in some sort of draft status, you know, so that Lovecraft could read it and go, I bet I could take these elements and do something a little better with it.
True.
So in that respect, the unpolished nature of it is kind of good.
Yeah, it's inspiring. I know we have no proof that Lovecraft actually read this. He never talked about it in any letter that I'm aware of or any of the research that I found. He never wrote about it, so he might not have read it. It is the first issue of Weird Tales, which he might not have even picked up. You know, if the first issue comes out, you don't know what it is. It's not until people start talking about something, maybe the second, third, or fourth issue comes out, and then you're like, oh, there's this magazine. It's pretty cool. It's got these rad stories.
Yeah, picked it up at the steakhouse. I was just in there, had the meat sweats, needed something to read. It's Weird Tales right there in the stall.
So it's possible he didn't read it, or maybe he went back and then read it after the fact, if he was able to find back issues. I don't know, but man, it sure seems like Lovecraft got some ideas from this story. Or it's just part of the zeitgeist.
Yeah, I think you know, a little from column A, a little from column B. He probably read it. And it was anthologized a lot. I was thinking that we covered it at some point, but I was thinking about Slime, which I love.
Yeah.
Which was the...
How could you confuse ooze with slime?
I know. I don't know what's wrong with me. I got to slow down. I want to thank our reader. I keep saying Anne Elizabeth, but she goes by Fool. I feel mean calling her Fool. It's like when we were younger and we worked together. I remember one of the first days you started on the job, I yelled across the room, hey, Lackey! The guy I worked for was like, you talk to him that way? I thought he was your friend.
Really? Now that's his name.
That's his name. And similarly, our reader today is Fool! And she's great. I love her. And go check out Fool and the Gang on Fridays. We'll put all the links up to that stuff in the show notes. And I also want to thank some patrons.
Yeah, I'd like to thank Sherry Hightower.
I'd like to thank good old Tom.
Thomas Lacey, thank you.
Dan Kramer, thank you.
Thank you, Aaron Butcher.
Ronnie Anderson, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Michael Guillory.
Morgan Jenkins, thank you.
Iron Tusk Painting?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Iron Tusk Painting, and also thank you, Matt H. You guys are great. This has been Monster Maker Month. We're actually going to dip into some Farnsworth, right? We talked about it enough.
Yeah, we're going to do it.
Yeah, I looked up his stories from this issue, and or I think it was from this issue and another one. So we're going to do a twofer, just like two hogs. We're going to have two Farnsworth Wright stories next week. And I don't know if there's monster making involved. We'll do these two. They're early Weird Tales Farnsworth Wright stories. We'll see what this guy's got.
What's he got in the barrel?
I don't know if monsters are in them, but I'm hoping. We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see. That's all we have for this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
Strange studies of strange stories here at hppodcraft.com and Patreon.
hppodcraft.com.